welcome to the Explorers Podcast with Ken Bowen. Here, Ken connects with friends and peers to discuss issues in the world and practices to improve one's biblical perspective.
Welcome to Explorers, and I'm with my associate, Cameron McAllister, and we're going to have a creative dialogue with a fundamental theme in mind, and it's going to have to do with the issue of loneliness in our time and our culture. And Cameron, I want to welcome you for being a part of this. Yeah.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah. It's great to be here with you. Yeah, loneliness obviously has been declared by the Surgeon General an epidemic. There's something strange, something about that is strange to me from the onset, Ken, because loneliness, on the one hand, you would think that we're in a moment where we are more connected than we've ever been, and yet we feel very lonely. And also, if we're treating loneliness like a physical condition, That seems a strange way to approach it, because just a few things, just to set this up, Ken, stand yes. out about loneliness to me. People will point out that you can feel lonely in a crowded place, and you can feel content in a relatively secluded place.
Yes.
I think about Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver walking mm-hmm. down those yes. crowded streets of New
Precisely,
York
yes.
saying, "I'm God's lonely man." But, or you can be, you know, in a secluded spot in, you know, nature, if you're hiking or something like that, and you feel perfectly content, you don't feel alone. So that seems to point to the fact that loneliness is more of a spiritual condition with physical outworkings, of course, sometimes.
Yes.
But we're treating it, as is typical of modern people, as almost just a purely physical problem. So I really wanted to bring it up and get your thoughts on
yes.
why that would be so, and what's really slowing us down from getting to the underlying condition.
Yes. I think it makes sense that a postmodern culture that has eliminated the spiritual also eliminates the consciousness of the mind. It comes down to the point where we're just almost like a thing in the box. It's just like it's just basically a brain in a vat almost. And it's almost as though there is no real authenticity in terms of the spiritual dynamics or the psychological dynamics. But now it is treated as a physical malady. And so this reductionistic notion of physicalism eliminates the whole realm of the soma. All you have is left is the soma, the body, mm-hmm. not the psuche, mm-hmm. the psyche, and not the pneuma, the spirit. And so in my view, when I'm meeting with people and I see someone who's suffering from this, I want to consider not just that there may be an organic problem or something of that nature, or certain cultural conditions that need to be resolved by certain techniques, but more than that, there's also a psychological embeddedness that this tears away at us because of trauma and broken relationships and alienation that's part of the human condition. And also then third, there's a spiritual dynamic that's utterly overlooked if we don't take that into account as well.
Yeah, I'm remembering words from Thomas Wolfe, the great Southern novelist.
Yes.
When he talked about loneliness being, I won't get his beautiful phrases here, but basically loneliness is the spiritual condition of humanity.
Yes.
But what strikes me is that loneliness is a result, especially here in North America right now. We're at a cultural juncture where we have been for a long time just tearing up our Christian heritage. This has been happening for a long time. It's been happening for a long time in the West as
Indeed,
well.
Yes.
But we're at a place now where we are truly seeing the outworkings of that endeavor of, you know, Os Guinness says we're a cut flower society.
Yes.
But now that flower is starting to wilt. And so we're looking at a lot of these problems that we're facing just in our own lives, loneliness being a huge one. And it strikes me that what's happened is we are facing estrangement first and foremost from our Maker. And that's the fundamental relationship
yes,
that's been compromised.
That's correct.
And then from that, you've got that follows the wreckage of other human relationships that are falling apart.
Yes.
But it starts first and foremost with the broken relationship with our Creator. And we're just trying to medicate it away, or trying to
medicate it away.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's the sad fact that we're looking at right now, Ken. Yes. That's what I'm trying to think through, how we start to redirect our thoughts here, because this kind of thinking creeps into our churches
as
well.
It does indeed. As Thomas Merton so beautifully put it, we're not at peace with ourselves because we're not at peace with God. And we're not at peace with one another because we're not at peace with ourselves. That's how he starts.
Yes.
And then we're not at peace with ourselves because we're not at peace with God. So there's an interior problem that then manifests itself in the overt distortions of exterior relationships. Mm. And we are also a culture that's been living for a long time on the borrowed capital of a discarded worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And that now is beginning to haunt us, and it's beginning to take its vengeance because that capital has been used up largely.
And I'm wondering, Ken, because I know you've done some thinking about sources of meaning and identity that are essential to us here. And I'm wondering what bearing those thoughts have on the discussion of loneliness.
Yes. I've been thinking about, Cameron, about four questions I now ask myself. The fundamental question of where did I come from? The mm-hmm. second obvious question is, who am I? And then third is, why am I here? And then fourth, where am I going? So when I ask those four questions, which people have an incredible capacity of averting and avoiding decades sometimes, it's astonishing until they're forced, perhaps by a funeral, that force themselves in that uncomfortable position of their awareness of their mortality. But then happily, I think I got the wheel now. I got it now. Thanks for the help. And we act as if it never happened to us. But the first question is the most fundamental, is the question of, where did we come from? Because if my answer is not a personal ultimate, an infinite and personal mm-hmm. ultimate that transcends time and space, it's not big enough. And so where I come from, there's no meaning. So that's the first mm-hmm. question, isn't there? So without that meaning nexus, let's think about what your thoughts are about that first question.
Where I come from. Well, I think it's huge because, and it's important to say this too, Ken. I think, you know, you and I are kind of nerds, and we're standing here, we're naming writers and philosophers. But for a lot of us, we don't have to have read these people to have them function almost as default settings for us. So we've absorbed the thought almost by cultural osmosis, whether we recognize it or not. So with regard to where do we come from? I think a lot of us, and Christians included, unfortunately, have managed to push aside the thought that I'm a child of God. I mean, ultimately, that's the fundamentally, who are you?
Who are you?
You're a child of God. Yeah. But if you've bought into the cultural narrative, I think always of the phrase that Sartre gave us, existence precedes essence.
Essence, yes, right.
And I think we're living in the shadow of that statement. I think a lot of people basically think, yeah, but it's really who I am is kind of up to me. You know, I'm responsible for myself and my identity, and I need to form an identity, and I need to figure out who I am. And
yes.
You know, maybe I read a book on discovering my inner child. Yeah. Maybe I, you know, hike the Appalachian Trail. Yeah. I don't know. But I need to do something that reveals to me who I am, or I have to make myself. It's my own responsibility. Yeah.
I have to find myself almost.
It's like peeling
back a layer of an onion, and there's another layer underneath, and then peeling back that, there's another layer until you come down to the center and there's nothing left. So there's
right.
It's empty at the core, and then we ask, now what am I?
Or you go on some big arduous trip, you backpack through Europe, mm-hmm. or you do hike the Appalachian Trail, and at the end of it, supposedly there's going to be the real you waiting for you to shake your hand, and now you can be authentic.
Yeah.
But I think if we take a step back, we can recognize, as Christians, we recognize that the burden of identity was never something that was meant to be in human hands. And also, I mean, everything, the most essential, wonderful things about life are givens. But those are the very things that we are pushing back against most fiercely as
That's
a culture.
Correct.
I mean, even without getting into too many of the, you know, really radical identity experiments of our culture. I mean, people rejecting their very gender, people rejecting their names,
yes.
people rejecting the bodies they were born in. Now that's an outworking of thinking. I I'm really from nowhere.
Yes.
And I make myself.
Yes. So the self-made creature, and then as a consequence, he worships his own maker. So at the end of the day, we go from meaning. Is there any meaning at all? In other words, where did I come from? And if there's not something transcendent, really the answer, if you really thought it through, we are just the impersonal byproduct of an utterly random context in which it has no care about whether we exist or not. We're just a byproduct, an episode between two oblivions, a cosmic blip. And that's just not enough to sustain us, because the Imago Dei is hardwired, we're God-haunted, which brings us to the question of identity. Mm-hmm. The question is, who am I? And that's really now where we're getting to the core of this question of loneliness, because people's identity is based upon the wrong sources.
Well, if you think, I mean, again, just speaking very practically, if you, whether you've clearly articulated this or not, but if you think that you are somehow a byproduct of random unguided forces, well, that's an intrinsically meaningless point of origin. And if you think you are Mr. or Mrs. Nobody until you self-define or make yourself somehow, that also, the takeaway from that is, on the one hand, it may sound really liberating for a season. I can be whatever I want to be. I can be whoever I want to be. I can live authentically. But then you come back again and again to, first of all, I'm on my own, totally on my own. And also the question arises that, well, what do I want to be, and who really am I? I mean, we go through different phases. We go through different seasons of life. A person will change. What is there that is stable in that you can actually hold on to in terms of your identity? If you don't accept anything is
that's
given.
Right. Yeah, it reminds me of the Rolling Stone, like a Rolling Stone. So basically, on my own without a home, there's no identity. So the question is going to be whether it's the world that's going to define us or there another source of identity, namely the word. And that becomes the all important ultimate question of who gets to define me, because if the world has a way of asking the question, what have you done for me lately? And it's a performance-based thing as well.
Thank you for tuning in to the Explorers Podcast. We'd like to remind you that Reflections Ministries is supported by the generosity of our friends like you. If you'd like to donate, please visit reflections.org today. Now back to the podcast.
You know, what's striking about this is human beings are peculiar creatures for many different reasons, but one of them is that we have to be told who we are.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think it's helpful to put it in those terms. I was saying that to a bunch of college students recently. I mean, again, talk about if you want to have a young person look at you like you have horns growing out of your head, say that to them. No, you have to be told who you are.
Yeah.
But if you do a little thinking, you can, I think, bring a person to at least appreciate that thought a little bit, because after all, let's just think about human beings and our human relationships. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're born in circumstances of total and complete dependency and vulnerability, a helpless baby, and people pour into us. You know, if circumstances are good, we have good families. Sadly, this isn't always the case, but our families, our friends, our teachers, our coworkers, schoolyard bullies, for better or for worse, the great menagerie of people in our lives pour into us and also help to show us who we are. I remember when I was in, I know you, Ken, you just had your life has been so much more interesting than mine in every single way. You have had a fun, bizarre life, and it's fun to hear about it. But in those days, I imagine you had similar instances. But when I was in high school, I thought I knew who I was, and I thought I was going to be really, you know, aggressive metal musician. I just knew that's who I was.
Right.
But there were about three English teachers, and I was an abysmal student at this point. Didn't want to crack a book, didn't care about the life of the mind or anything like that. But I had about three English teachers, God bless them, who saw something in my writing, and they said, Cameron, you know, you actually are a writer. I think this is you're actually a thinker. This is who you are. And they had intelligence on me that I didn't have. They saw something in me.
That's right.
They offered me genuine insight, and they were right. Yeah. And I needed them to tell me who I was.
It's mediated, isn't it? Because our ultimate needs are actually from God. He is the source, but God mediates that source through the agency of people who are in our lives that he's put there. And those are people who saw a potential in you that you yourself did not grasp. Mm-hmm. And I, the same thing. I can think, you made me immediately think of your three English teachers. I can think of one was an English teacher. One was a Latin teacher, another was a music teacher, and each of them, and I went back, I wanted to thank them. I could only find one.
Yeah,
when I realized, you know, because I always tell people in any relationship, when you want to have closure, did you speak your love? Did you speak your gratitude? And was there any unfinished business? And so I went back. And so there were 10 who were lepers who were healed. Is there only this one to thank me? So I came back and thanked him. And my gosh, it made all the difference in the world. It was so few have done that. But my point is, here's a person who believed in you. People who believed in you and saw something in you, you yourself didn't see. And if you were defined merely by the opinions of your peers, it wouldn't have been sufficient because you would have been defined too lowly.
Did the teacher remember you, Ken?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. We were actually very close. We would actually go to plays together and things of that together. So it was a Latin teacher.
Wow.
And so we had actually done a lot of things together, but I realized I never went back and thanked him. Oh, my word, what a difference that made. And yeah. I tried hard to find the other two. I wish I could have. But did you speak your gratitude? Because here's a person who gave you a word of sanity and authenticity and meaning rather than the problem of the loneliness of people who are cultivating and curating friends that don't even exist but have the illusion of being friends, but they're not at all. But they're more isolated, more lonely, more digitized, more isolated now, I fear, than ever before. So we had that. You and I were similar, too, I noticed, because I was a goofus. And I didn't want to read anything. Mm-hmm. I tried to get away with reading as little as I could and just being lazy, you know. But again, you and I had a similar parallel, didn't we? We had something that the people saw, and allowing a person who loves us to define us rather than the people who are just trying to compare us with other people and just reduce us down to the common denominator. I think that loneliness is huge because people are people without friends. The authenticity of friends and mentors and people who are further down the road who can instruct and guide us and empower us and encourage us.
We need to press into that for a second because I think this is getting to something that's very tender for many people. In order to have those kinds of relationships, of course, you mentioned that increasingly a lot of friendships are imaginary or really digital or kind of abstracted.
Yes.
You have to be willing to have people speak into your life. And it seems to me a big source of our loneliness is that we've got, you know, you'll hear advice about, well, and now we'll tread carefully here because there are circumstances where you do have relationships that are bad relationships and boundaries do need to be established.
Of course,
okay.
So.
Granted.
Yeah.
But you have language like, well, this is a toxic person. So just cut them out of your life. And I fear that sometimes that is code for, this is a person who routinely says things to me that I don't want to hear. And I don't need that negativity in my life, so I'm going to cut them out. And let me tell you, when I didn't necessarily like what these teachers were saying to me at the time, the people who have loved me and cared for me the most and been the best of friends to me have been those who have been willing to offend me.
That's correct.
And say, Cameron, you're going wrong.
That's
here.
Correct. They're telling you, they're taking the risk in the relationship, by the way, of being truthful to you, and because they love you that much. And so faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. And so most people will deceitfully kiss us and tell us what we want to hear, but that's not what we need to hear. And the people who love us most know what we most need, but they also take a risk of hurting the relationship, because I had an experience like that very recently with an individual in one of my groups. It was a discipleship group, and I found that he would go into the modality of teaching, And it was a need that he had, I saw. There was a fundamental need that he needed to be heard, but he was dominating the group. So I took a terrible risk when I corresponded with him and told him, you have some great insights, but sometimes you just use it as a point of teaching or lecturing. And he didn't want to hear that. I didn't hear from him for 3 weeks. But then he wrote back and said, you were right.
Wow.
And the upshot is that now he's in still part of that group. He participates rather than teaches, doesn't lecture. Now, what I love is the tender heart of a man who's willing to be corrected, because how can we find our way unless we have people love us enough to take the risk of guiding us and instructing us? But if we're not open to receptivity and hearing that, we're going to be defined by the subjective foolishness of people, of the mooing herd.
Right. We have to be willing to receive correction. And then, of course, brings us to one of the ways in which the Lord gets through to me most clearly, and this makes sense, I'm a Presbyterian, it's hard for me to hear the voice of God but is through the conviction of the Holy Spirit revealing to me my own shortcomings. Not in some, and it's really important to point this out, because this can go wrong. Not in some dark type of shameful despondency. That's often tool of the enemy.
That's correct. Yes.
But rather in a form of conviction that shows me my own weaknesses and if I'm humble and willing to submit, my need and dependency on my Lord.
That's right.
And it's a very visceral way of understanding it is not I who live, but Christ in me.
It's an apprehension that you're experiencing existentially, and you realize that you're in going through this moment of crisis, and there's a need for a word of authority, a word of support, a word of encouragement, a word of clarity in the midst of this din of confusion that we otherwise will hear everybody's narratives and everybody's self-serving approaches. So to train ourselves requires often a willingness to realize everything is gift and grace. The gift of humility is it's not achieved by trying, but by realizing everything you are and have is gift and grace. You don't have, what do you have that wasn't given to you?
Right.
Then why would you boast as if it wasn't given? I love that rhetorical question. The answer is nothing. I don't have anything.
Nothing.
And the realization is, it sets me free to realize I have nobody to prove, nothing to prove, and nobody to impress. My gosh, that changes the rules, because then I have a sense of identity that's based upon something much more than just the earthbound nexus, but something transcendent that's permanent, that's authorized from above, but mediated through people in my visible spheres of relationships. It's a lovely thought.
So, I mean, the massive benefits that come from the recognition of asking the question, where do I come from? And saying very clearly, well, my life is a gift from the Lord.
Everything is gift.
The Lord made me, knit me in my mother's womb. I'm not here on accident. I exist for a reason. I have a purpose is woven into the fabric of my life. Mm-hmm. And who am I? I'm a child of God.
Yes.
But then on the basis of that, if we can really, and this is where the disciplines come in, Ken, I would imagine, right?
I think so.
Taking hold of those truths in a tangible way by, you know, through the meditation on God's word, scriptural memorization, prayer, fasting, all of these wonderful God-given kind of traditions.
And time-tested traditions.
Time-tested,
yeah.
If we can do that, then we can come, because I think we face the fact that a lot of people are still lonely in their day-to-day lives. They're lonely in their marriages.
They're
lonely in their churches.
People need to, they're not heard. We have to pay professionals to hear us, which is a sadness.
Yep.
It's a distorted good. And we know that there was a greater context, at least, not to say it was things, those are the good old days, but rather that at least there was some more cultural awareness of the need for us to communicate and to actually have the body of Christ, the communion, community. Mm-hmm. I always say there are four things that are needful for our growth, and one of them is the Word of God, the other one is prayer, the scriptures and our response to it. But then the third is community. You can't live without it. But the fourth is suffering and growing through that adversity so that we are now humbled to the point where He must increase and we must decrease, and then we discover our true selves by losing Him. That's not intuitive. That's not obvious. But sure. Yet it's countercultural and counterintuitive, and yet we know it's the way of life because it's not conditioned on people's opinions and expectations.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it strikes me, Ken, you took the risk with this person in your life.
Yes, I did. I was really hesitant because I knew a lesser man. So I'm really kind of testing his mettle in another way, but as well. But I knew I couldn't let it keep on going. It was affecting the quality of our whole group discussion. And instead of in a participation, it was oh, here's my opportunity now to wax eloquent and to pontificate. Hard to do, that was.
It is. And do you think, though, that so if we've taken granted we're working toward in our prayer and in our scripture reading to take hold of the fact that we're made by God, for God, we belong to Him, our identity is grounded and mm-hmm. safe and secure there. We're still, it strikes me, the reason a lot of us are lonely is because we're afraid to take those risks in the relationship, in our closest relationships.
I think that's correct. You know, I've often said that it's loving God completely empowers us to love ourselves correctly, which is to choose to believe that what God says about us when He says, who are you? This is who you are. And we may have filters, cultural filters, theological filters, emotional filters mm-hmm. that'll filter that mm-hmm. out. But the more we we choose to believe it's true, I don't even feel that way, but you say so. It's creating, that's training, isn't it? Where we train yes. ourselves to begin to believe that what He says is so. And the more we do that, the more free I set myself free from the illusions that I have to be defined by people. Now I can serve them and be secure enough to serve them, even if there's no reciprocity. That's revolutionary. I wonder how many people arrive at that. And even when we do, we slip back, don't we, into that
mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Into that we go back from off away from grace. We go back to law. It's our natural bent and disposition to quantify, count, and control. So we try to create conditions in which we measure and quantify those relationships. It's hard. It's not grace driven.
It's not. And in our supremely connected moment, you know, our technologies allow us to put a distance between people and ourselves in ways that we didn't before. You can have, to a degree, you can have people on your own terms right now. You can keep them at a distance. But the real risk comes in when you're just in those face-to-face encounters, when you're actually with people, you're with your close friends, you're with your family members, you're with your spouse. Now, sadly and interestingly, these are all the relationships that we struggle the most with right now.
That's correct.
The people we're the closest to. And so I think just taking into account your example that you gave, Ken, if we're pressing into who we are and we're rooted in the reality of God's love and claim on our lives, that ought to free us up to take those risks, to have those hard conversations with people we love. And the risk, what's the risk? Well, the risk is you lose the friendship. You lose the relationship.
Yeah, that's exactly that. That's the risk of, and it's a profound risk, and people are often unwilling to be honest because they're afraid of that diminishment, mm-hmm. that loss, and so forth. So I'm just thinking about the things that I have loved and seen. You and I are lovers of film, and there's a couple of films that I saw quite recently. I subscribe to Kino Lorber, which is, and they have odd and exotic films, foreign films that I have been forced to see, or wanting to see that I've
lots
never
of seen. German stuff,
yeah,
right?
Lots of German things, but also one was called Utama and was about Bolivia, and it was about these people who are raising llamas, and just the identity issues, and just to see, oh my word, it comes back to the fundamental, what I loved about that film was an artful expression of the fundamental decision. Do I, it's rain, there's not enough rain here, and it hasn't rained, and so it's mm-hmm. Or should we go to the city and lose our identity there? And so, but just the fundamentals, and I saw how utterly consistent the human condition was, a man not willing to admit that he was ill to his wife and so forth, and the reconciliations that her grandson brought. But the simplicity of a story that's redemptive, and don't we long for that? We long for the good ending of a convergence, of a mutual, something understood, something that we understand together. And it led that way very much. There's another film I saw called The Pearl Button. Odd things, and it was extraordinarily rich and profound. But again, now this happens in Patagonia, and so this is a whole array of things that, and their connectedness with one another and their community, and how they lost losing their identity because of the oppression of others that have now destroyed their communities and so forth. But again, what I'm saying is, when I see these films from different parts of the world, and yours the same way, you know that we're talking about the human condition, whether it's in the past or the present, whether it's any part of the world, but the same fundamental issues, because we're all bearers of the Imago Dei, are there, and they ring true. The need for overcoming of estrangement, isolation, alienation, loneliness, despair. And it's more, as you rightly say, than some physical condition that can be medicated. There is, of course, a component of that, perhaps. Sure. But again, that's the somatic part. But we have that's why we have psuche and the psychosomatic, the psyche. So the mind-body connection there. And there's no question as well that the spiritual dimension will affect our bodily. So there's a we're holistic beings, but only I think the biblical vision gives us a big, broad enough nexus to contextualize our fundamental relational needs that we've been granted, incredible needs that we have. The question of who am I, of who defines it, God's world, the word, or our world, and then why am I here? What's my purpose? Who defines that, and where am I going? Who defines that? Is there hope? Is there hope on both sides of the grave?
Yes, I think for many people, these questions have a new. They're ringing with a new degree of urgency.
They are.
These days.
I think that's correct. A new degree of urgency is a good way to put it. That there is something, because it's amplified. I think the condition is now of the miasma of loneliness and of the lost of relationships, and the illusion that my friends, so called, are real friends, and then the illusion of people playing to and exposing their deepest concerns and secrets to complete strangers, which I marvel that they think that. I sometimes amaze me. They forgot that everyone else is listening in. They wouldn't tell their dearest friend, but they'll tell this bizarre thing. But so much is the need to be connected.
Well, I mean, we're at a place now where I think we can say, without being cynical, it's not working. Our current methods of treatment are not working. We are at a point of serious cultural breakdown.
Yes.
But we're also at a point, the interesting thing here, this has occurred to me a lot lately. I've been thinking about this. It used to be the case, I think Peter Kraft makes this point. He said, so in the Middle Ages, the gospel was seen as too good to be true. And now we no longer think it's good enough. But I think actually we're coming to a point where when people truly recognize the miracle of the gospel, the wonder of it, that no, you were made by God for God. Yes, you are worse in many ways than you think you are, but you have forgiveness is available to you. You are loved beyond what you could ever imagine. People, because this is a side note, but we're in a cultural moment where forgiveness is in short supply.
Very short supply.
I mean, this is in many ways, it's a fiercely sort of prudish, almost pharisaical.
It's legalistic
moment.
And
very
it's
legalistic.
Extreme, and they grant no grace or no quarter for anyone who doesn't abide it by their illusory system that they've cogitated for themselves and conjured up out of the darkness of their own broken intellect, because it's no longer connected with the source of reason and evidence and so forth, and so they cogitate and conjure.
Well, and you and I can both know people who have been, quote, canceled, who have had their careers ended, destroyed.
graceless and humorless as well.
Oh, fanatic. No humor.
See, no, when you get more and more fanatical, you lose your sense of humor, your sense of proportion. You can't laugh at yourself or anything else, and it's frightening. And then there's a loss of creativity in the arts, as you well know, too. Socialist arts don't do real well and so forth.
Shostakovich.
Yeah.
It's true because, and I mean, listeners, you'll have noticed that there's comedians who are actually funny are in kind of short supply lately because humor's dangerous. Humor's all about pointing out incongruities. And if you have a pharisaical moment where everybody has this kind of zealous commitment to political ends, then everything becomes propaganda.
That's right. Yeah.
But it's in this context, Ken, that I think people are finally coming to a place where they're recognizing once again, oh, wow, this really is too good to be true. Could it really be that I could be, that forgiveness is available?
Yes.
That we don't have to be lonely, that we can live our life before an audience of one.
Yes, yes.
That we are loved and cherished no matter what others tell us. So, I mean, I think if there are two takeaways from what we've been talking about, Ken, it's that for those of us who follow Christ, I mean, the supreme word on who we are comes to us from our Lord, and then it is also mediated through his people.
There you go.
But we have to be willing to receive it, because the people who, we all know this, the people who love us the most, care about us the most, the people who are going to often challenge us the most, because they're the ones who know what a knucklehead you are.
Precisely so. They care. They're willing to take the risk. So you're quite right that God is our source of provision of all these things, but he mediates it through people. So they may be a means that he may or may not use, but he's the source, so I don't have to manipulate them to get my needs met. But on the other hand, I'm secure enough that I can serve people and give them the word of truth. I think the most countercultural thing we can do right now is to cultivate authentic friendship.
Mm. Well, that's a good word. Well, I think we all should turn that over in our minds for a little bit. Cultivate true friendship.
It's so countercultural, because then true friends know what it is, the grace of laughing at things that were injurious, but then you realize you have perspective and you let loose of that thing and you don't funnel resentments, and you learn how, because you can't have a friendship if there's resentment or if there's unforgiveness. And so it mediates that. And I have a friend who's going to tell me and give me the grace, and I have to give them the same. That's so countercultural, but it's so authentic.
Mm. It's a good word. Well, Ken, this has been, a pleasure talking with you. We'll do it again soon. And Thanks for listening in. This has been the Explorers Podcast.
Thank you for being a part of the Explorers Podcast. Please like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.